Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups and was recorded on Monday, June 17, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. Today we're going to be discussing several of the Supreme Court decisions handed down earlier this morning. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. On the Arizona voter ID preemption case, we're going to hear from Dean Emeritus John Eastman and Eric Jaffe, a private appellate practitioner here in Washington, D.C. On the criminal cases, Salinas and, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Alain, we will hear from Brian Murray of Jones Day. And on the reverse payments patent case, we're going to hear from Professor Stephen Yelderman. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of about 5 to 8 minutes, and then we'll take questions on all the cases or any of the cases at the end of the final presentation. Their full bios have been provided on our website and in the notice of today's call. We've got a lot of ground to cover, which explains why I'm being so particularly brief in my introductions. But with that, Eric Jaffe, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having me. So on Arizona versus the Intertribal Council of Arizona, the voter proof of citizenship case, the court held 7-2 with Justice Scalia writing that Arizona's requirement that you submit proof of citizenship with the federal form was preempted by the federal statute. This should come as very little surprise for folks who watched or listened to the argument. And in fact, even Scalia, writing for the majority, should come as very little surprise, given that he all but telegraphed his dissatisfaction with Arizona, the way Arizona had handled the case at the time. The basic reasoning of the opinion is that the statute, which requires Arizona to accept and use a federal registration form, means what it seems to say, which is to accept and use it means you have to use it as sufficient to satisfy the requirements of registration. So that rather than simply accept it, as in taking it out of the envelope, putting it aside and waiting for 10 other things you've asked for. There's no real surprise in that. One could have quibbled, and certainly under a sort of strong presumption against preemption, one might have more easily quibbled with what accept and use means, but that part of Scalia's opinion is not terribly troubling, at least not to me, though it was troubling to Justice Alito and to some extent to Justice Thomas as well. The other more interesting part of what Scalia said is that the reason this difficulty arose in the first place is because when Arizona asked for its additional requirements to be added to the federal form, its requirements to show proof of citizenship, the Election Assistance Commission, which is the federal agency that sort of formulates these forms, refused. And then when they sort of appealed to the full commission, the commission split 2-2 and was unable to come to a decision. And so at the end of the day, Arizona's otherwise legitimate request for information wasn't included in the federal form. And Scalia points out that this was probably ridiculous, that the agency should have said yes, and that in the future Arizona can ask again, and if the agency ever gets its act together or gets enough members to actually vote on something, which it doesn't have at the moment, they would almost be compelled to grant Arizona's request. And if they didn't, Arizona has a number of judicial review steps that it could take. So at the end of the day, the short and long of it is that while Arizona lost the case, they probably won the war. At the end of the day, if the EAC doesn't include their proof of citizenship data request in the federal form, the federal government will eventually lose some judicial decision telling them they have to do that. And if they still dig in their heels, then it's very likely that this will all end up being an unconstitutional infringement on Arizona's rights to determine voter qualifications. And Scalia sort of lays that out, though that's sort of a 5 or 10 year litigation plan, which is a little stupid in and of itself. At the end of the day, Arizona won. It may just take them a while to actually realize the fruits of their victory. I thought the interesting part of the two dissents were sort of in noting the constitutional tension in sort of interfering with Arizona's ability to enforce voter qualifications, i.e. their requirement that voters be citizens. And that's I think, all true. I think at some level Scalia agrees with that. He just provides a more convoluted path to enforcing that, whereas the dissenters would have provided a quicker path to enforcing that by using Arizona's interest of constitutional magnitude in order to interpret the statute more narrowly and give Arizona more leeway at the front end. Either version of it is sort of reasonable. I actually think Scalia's is probably technically more correct, though practically more of a pain in the rear. And so it sounds like Scalia and Justice Ginsburg got together and did a procedural dance, and this is what you got, which is not terribly surprising, quite frankly. So that's all I have for now, and questions later will be fine. Thanks.
John Eastman?
So, I agree with Eric's assessment that Scalia has laid out a path here for Arizona ultimately to win. But I want to put it in the larger context of what the so-called tension between the clauses is, and also the backdrop of core principles of federalism that arise out of our Constitutional Convention. The two clauses in the Constitution that are issue here is Article 1, Section 4, which assigns primary responsibility for setting the time, place, and manner of elections to the states. The concern of the members of the Federal Convention was that the states might use that power to prevent the election of members of Congress altogether, and therefore prevent the national government from being able to operate. So there's a preemption clause that allows Congress to override or to adopt their own time, place, and manner restrictions in order to make sure that we're having federal elections. There's another clause, though, that there's no ambiguity about who's not only primarily but solely responsible for, and that is the sole responsibility for defining qualifications for electors rests with the states. And Arizona, as every other state, includes as one of its qualifications that you be a citizen. And Arizona also now tries to determine how to meet that qualification. And there's no dispute, either among the majority opinion or the dissenting opinions, that's part of the qualifications power reserved to the states, that they get to define how to prove or verify that has been met. What's odd here is that Justice Scalia and the majority read into the manner language in Article 1, Section 4, the ability to set registration as well. And that's, registration is not a manner of holding elections, but much more going to who's qualified for elections. So I think the dissents probably have the stronger argument here. In order to avoid constitutional problems intruding on the state's sole power to define qualifications, we ought to read the National Voter Registration Act in a way that doesn't intrude on the states. And I think, quite frankly, Justice Thomas in dissent and Justice Alito have the better part of that argument. Now, as I said at the beginning, though, I do agree with Eric Jaffe that Justice Scalia, at the end of the day, agrees with that. He's just set some procedural hurdles for Arizona to go through to get to that point. They have to ask the permission of the federal government to get this verification documentation language in the federal form. And if the Election Assistance Commission either is inoperative or refuses to do that, they can file suit. And there's a little footnote. Justice Scalia wonders how the federal courts could order an agency that doesn't exist to take the action, but he'll sort that out later. It seems like a lot of unnecessary hurdles, and particularly odd coming, I think, from Justice Scalia, who just a year ago in the Arizona immigration case takes one of the most hardline defenses of state sovereignty that's ever been issued in the U.S. reports of any Supreme Court opinion. And here he's now making the states kind of come hat in hand to the federal government, begging permission to do something that the Constitution specifically authorizes them to do. So there's a great deal of irony when you look at some of these larger fights over state sovereignty going on here, as it was Scalia authoring this opinion. The second real bit of irony is that comes in the concurring in judgment opinion by Justice Kennedy, who takes issue with Justice Scalia for rejecting the normal presumption against preemption. Justice Kennedy provides a fairly strong defense of the presumption against preemption and why we have it. And yet Justice Kennedy was the one that abandoned that presumption of preemption just a year ago when Arizona was back before the court addressing its immigration law in SB 1070. And so there's a lot of pieces of this case dripping with irony on the overall background principles of state sovereignty.
Thank you very much. That was John Eastman. If you've joined us late, we're going to hear next from practitioner Brian Murray of Jones Day, who's going to talk to us about the two criminal cases. Brian.
Good afternoon, everybody. Today was quite a day in criminal law at the U.S. Supreme Court. Two cases to talk about. One is the Salinas case, and maybe that's the easiest place to start. Salinas bears on the question of what does it mean to have a right to remain silent, and specifically, how far can the government go in introducing evidence against you that you exercise that right to remain silent when being questioned by police officers. I mean, the facts of the case were fairly simple. There was a murder of two individuals in Houston, Texas. Investigators showed up to interrogate Mr. Salinas, who had attended the party at those folks' home the night prior. They found him at his parents' home. The father produced a shotgun. But Salinas voluntarily went with the police to the police station to be questioned. So you have this whole question of when you voluntarily go to the police station and then you answer questions for about an hour, and then all of a sudden you stop when the investigator asks you this question, what's the impact? And the question was, if the shotgun that his father had given them would match the shells recovered at the scene of the murder. At that point, Mr. Salinas looked at the floor, shuffled his feet, and didn't say anything. Interestingly, and this is sort of the part that we'll get to today's decision, but what's interesting is that today's decision doesn't make much of the fact that they tried Mr. Salinas and ended up in a hung jury where they didn't do much with this evidence. It was only the second time around where not only did they put in the evidence that he refused to answer that question, but they made a big deal out of it in the closing statement. And it was that time that the jury actually convicted. So, you know, whether this kind of evidence matters or not, I think this is a test case and shows you on its own facts that it really does. So as it came to the Supreme Court, the question was, does introducing that sort of evidence and then allowing the prosecutor to comment on it in closing, does that violate your right against self-incrimination? And today's opinion produces a really interesting split amongst the justices. You've got Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia sort of taking a hard line where they say that the right against self-incrimination isn't even implicated in a case like this. If all you're doing is commenting on silence and the fact that you chose not to answer questions, that doesn't make you incriminate yourself. It just comments on silence, and that was accepted, you know, long back into English practice and into the common law at the time of the founding. So no problem there. The constitutional protection doesn't even apply. Interestingly, though, Justices Alito and Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts took sort of a middle ground. They said there is protection here, but you actually have to invoke it. So it wasn't enough for Mr. Salinas just to remain silent in the face of this questioning. He actually had to say, I'm exercising my right to remain silent, or something along those lines, that without actually invoking that right, then you've waived the protections it provides. Justice Breyer wrote separately in dissent for himself, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan, and really sort of almost threw up his hands with a long historical discussion of what it means to invoke your right and how, on the facts and circumstances of this case, if the right's to have any meaning at all, what Mr. Salinas did ought to have been enough. You know, the fact that you subject to some questions and not others doesn't mean that when you get to the point where you want to stop answering, you have to make a big display of it. Really, just stopping answering the questions on the facts and circumstances of this case really ought to have been enough. It'll be interesting to see what this means going forward. You can imagine how this would apply in white-collar law, for example. You know, you have some sort of C-level executive hosting a barbecue when the feds show up. Is that person going to loudly say that I'm invoking my right against self-incrimination? You know, maybe, maybe not. But I bet there are going to be a lot of interesting conversations between lawyers and their clients in the next months trying to figure out what is the import of this decision and how ought we to rethink invoking your right to remain silent in light of today's decision. The second case, Alian, actually finally corrects a little bit of an anomaly in the post-Apprendi jurisprudence. So backing way, way up to the sleeper of OT 2000, the Apprendi case, you'll remember that Apprendi said that judges can't increase a sentence beyond a statutory maximum without a jury's assistance, that juries have to find facts that make your sentence longer. 2 years later, the court had ruled in Harris that facts that could raise a sentence above a minimum threshold did not have to be decided by a jury. So to make your sentence longer at the top end, jury. To make it mandatorily longer at the bottom end, no jury. At least that's how it was before we got to today's case. In Alien, you had the defendant who was accused of robbing the manager of a convenience store where his girlfriend had worked. And he was charged, as relevant here, under 18 U.S.C. 924C1A. And the way that statute works is it carries a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, But that goes up to 7 years if you brandish the firearm and 10 years if you discharge the firearm. The jury convicted on the five-year violation and did not find that the firearm was brandished. However, in the sentencing report, the prosecution recommended that he be sentenced for 7 years for brandishing, and the judge said, yep, that sounds right to me. I find that he brandished. And so the question was presented to the court, when you have, it's the Harris question, when you have a factor that increases a mandatory minimum, does that need to be decided by a jury, or as here, where a judge decides that, is that sufficient? And again, the case produces somewhat of an interesting split. You've got a majority opinion written by Justice Thomas, but joined by Justice Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, basically to overrule Harris. Justice Breyer wrote separately on narrow grounds to say that he doesn't really think Apprendi was rightly decided, and he still can't really quite get comfortable with it, but too much water has passed, and if you're going to have Apprendi, you got to get rid of Harris. You can't have them both. Somewhat of there was some volume in the dissent from Chief Justice Roberts that was joined by Justices Scalia, Alito, and Kennedy. They basically took the position that, look, you know, the mandatory, the maximum amount to which you could have been sentenced didn't change by virtue of this brandishing, so why in the world would you need to prove that to a jury? Going forward, the practical implications of this one could be significant. Whether this will end up mattering for habeas purposes, a retroactive rule still will have to be worked out. But this is a sea change. It does get rid of Harris, and you know, at least for those who saw the Harris-Apprendi tension as being an anomaly, it resolves that going forward.
All right. We'll hear next from Professor Stephen Yelderman, who's going to talk to us about the patent case and reverse payments. Professor.
Hi, thanks a lot. I'm happy to participate. So I'm going to talk about FTC versus Actavis, and just a quick bit of background on the case. So basically, the Hatch-Waxman Act bestows certain benefits on the generic manufacturer that happens to be the first to come in and challenge the patent that's underlying a patented drug. Or to spin it kind of more negatively, perhaps Hatch-Waxman disadvantages applicants who happen to not be the first one to make it into the door to challenge a patent. So Solvay Pharmaceuticals received a patent in 2003 for its drug Androgel. Later that year, Actavis filed an application and started this Hatch-Waxman challenge process. 3 years later, in 2006, the party settled. Actavis says it's not going to bring the drug to market until 65 months before the patent expires, so it's going to put aside its challenge for now, and it's going to help promote the drug with urologists. In exchange for this, Solvay, the patent holder, agrees to pay $19 to $30 million a year annually to Actavis. So this is the so-called reverse payment at issue here, because it's a flow of cash from the patent holder to the alleged infringer. So in 2009, the FTC brought a Section 5 suit challenging the settlement, saying this is basically an agreement to share Solvay's monopoly profits rather than to challenge that monopoly in court. The district court dismisses, saying this is an antitrust law violation. The 11th Circuit affirms, saying, look, Solvay's patent confers antitrust immunity on the particular anti-competitive effects that were alleged here by the FTC, because these effects are within the scope of the exclusion that would be granted by the patent, that are granted by the patent. So because this promise not to compete is only on activity within the scope of the patent, and it's during the terms of the patent, there's not really any reduction in competition between beyond what would otherwise be excluded under the patent grant itself. Even, of course, there's a real question here as to whether this patent is actually valid. And the 11th Circuit is very concerned about putting any obstacles in the way of parties who might be considering a settlement. So today's opinion reversed the 11th Circuit. That's a 5-3 opinion. It's written by Justice Breyer. It's 5-3. Alito did not participate in this case. And first and foremost, the court noted that this patent might not even be valid, and that in practice, this risk of invalidity limits the market power that's conferred on the patentee. The court went on to reject patent antitrust formalism, noting that whether restraint lies within the scope of a patent monopoly is really the question that's trying to be answered in these patent antitrust cases, and shouldn't be the starting point for an analysis. The court goes on to cite a variety of cases, noting how collusion between patent holders and challengers have had and can have anti-competitive effects, and notes that there's potential for real harm in this kind of settlement, where an invalid patent that without the settlement would have been invalidated and would have seen a generic competition entering the market that for a period of months or even years could be excluded and consumers are stuck with the pharmaceutical monopoly. The court acknowledges, of course, that settlement's a good thing, but a certain size of settlement can't be supported by traditional settlement considerations. There's a certain order of magnitude where avoiding further litigation kind of stuff's making sense, and it looks like, okay, maybe there really is a sharing of monopoly profits going on here, paying would-be competitors to stay out of the market. Finally, the court notes that these kinds of settlements are kind of end around the policy goals of Hatch-Waxman, which, of course, creates this regime to try to incentivize exactly these kinds of patent challenges. And as I mentioned at the beginning, there's particular advantages conferred on the first person in the door with the Hatch-Waxman challenge. So, to the extent that the first challenger can be bought off, it's not like there can just be a rush of generic manufacturers that can necessarily come in and fill the void. They're not going to have the same advantages that first challenger would have had. The court, however, rejected a presumption of antitrust harm or any kind of quick look approach, meaning that in the future these cases are going to be evaluated under a rule of reason analysis. Three justices dissented. The dissent was written by Justice Roberts, joined by Justices Scalia and Thomas. And Justice Roberts writes, look, this is just a payment for respecting the patent. This is within the scope of the patent. We're not talking about extending payment to extend patent rights beyond the terms of the patent or to conduct that wouldn't have been within the scope of the claims. And basically says, therefore, this is within the scope. And it's within that boundary of the monopoly that the patent right confers. Now, of course, there's a real tradition to this kind of formalism, and Justice Roberts cites it extensively, and points out that the court has never found an antitrust problem in failing to challenge a patent. There's a general preference for settlements, and there's nothing in the antitrust law that requires these patent grants to be challenged by third parties. So just to wrap it up, as a patent opinion, there's some real skepticism about patent validity lurking here. At the same time, the court seems to recognize that post-grant challenges, whether in court or before the patent office, or at least the threat of them, are an important component of how our patent system works today. As an antitrust opinion, there's not a lot of guidance in terms of how much is too much. There's a pretty wide range here of what falls within the rule of reason analysis. It might not be clear to those who are trying to resolve their patent lawsuits exactly when they're in bounds and when they're out of bounds. The dissent has a lot to say about that. And then as a patent and antitrust opinion, it's a very promising examination of the cost of benefits, the particular form of patentee immunity that are at stake here. Unfortunately, this balancing doesn't really even talk about the goal of increasing innovation. It's really encouraging competition that seals the show here. And of course, for purposes of patent antitrust analysis, it's really a balance of innovation and competition that are at play here. And it seems to be that the idea of encouraging competition really kind of seals the show. So it ends up being a rather one-sided balancing in the majority's opinion. So I'll leave it there for my opening remarks, and I'm happy to take questions at the end.
Thank you very much. Let's turn now to the audience for its questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Before we go to our first caller, let me make an announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., we'll host a panel discussion, sort of a reaction panel, that will take a deeper dive on the Myriad case, another IP case decided earlier in the term, quite recently. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Then on Wednesday, we'll host a debate on the Fed's stress testing standards for banks, capital standards for banks. And then on Thursday, we have scheduled a debate between Roger Clegg and Ted Shaw on disparate impact. But because that's now a decision day for the court, we're trying to remain flexible there. So we might have a a debate on Thursday on disparate impact, but we might switch gears there and cover whatever decision might come down on Thursday. Today we're talking with a panel of experts. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller. You might have your phone. Well, looks like we lost that caller. Well, at this point, we our lines are open. We don't have any callers in the queue. Push the star button and then the pound button if you want to join the conversation. Let me ask Eric Jaffe and or John Eastman, is there anything in today's opinion that leads you to any conclusions about any of the remaining cases, in particular Shelby County?
I suppose you could read some of the silliness about. I agree with John, by the way, that this notion of you don't apply the presumption against preemption. I thought the majority had the worst of that fight, and that the dissent had the meaningfully better of that fight. And in fact, even Justice Kennedy, I thought, correctly points out why that was silly. So I suppose if you read that overly broadly, you could say, well, they're going to give Congress a little more flexibility in regulating voting stuff. But I just don't think they're going to be that consistent, so I wouldn't read anything into it. Just like John pointed out that, you know, Scalia and Kennedy are flip-flopping on what they think about states' rights and presumptions and all that kind of good stuff. I don't think anyone's going to pause for even half a second over what they said in this case when figuring out what to do in the voting rights case.
Yeah, and if anything, Scalia's no presumption against preemption here, because this is an elections law clause case, and by definition, Congress is preempting state law whenever it acts. That doesn't exist in the Voting Rights Act Section 5 case, and so I suppose he's kind of given him a narrow way to come out the other direction, as I expect he's going to in the Shelby County case.
All right. Once again, if you have a question, our lines are open. We don't have any callers in the queue right now. We've got a lot of people on the phone. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question for any of our experts here today.
Dean, while we're waiting for a question, this is John Eastman. Why don't I go through some of the specific language in the intertribal case that I think Eric and I both agree is a huge win for Arizona, even though the bottom line in this particular case is they've got more work to do to get to that win. Justice Scalia, on page 15 of this slip opinion, says that we note that the states have the sole authority to define qualifications, and that includes the authority to confirm whether the qualifications have been met. That's a state power, not a federal power. That's pretty significant. And then he goes on to talk about a concession made by the United States at oral argument that the federal statute at issue here, which says that the federal government can or may require only the information necessary to determine eligibility, means that they must require that information if the state thinks it's necessary. That's a pretty strong concession made at oral argument that is now codified as part of the reasoning of the opinion. So it's going to be binding on the United States when Arizona goes back before the election commission here and asks for this language to be included on the federal form, that you can't just swear that you're a citizen. You have to be able to prove it with supporting documentation. And so Arizona is going to win that. Now, there's an interesting procedural question, because the EAC, this federal agency that's supposed to modify and approve changes to the federal registration form, isn't in existence right now. There are vacancies. They don't have the constitutional or statutory authority to take any action. And so how is Arizona supposed to get this change in the form put through? Like I said before, it seems like an unnecessary hurdle for Arizona to go through to vindicate the constitutional right it has to set and determine eligibility on the qualifications it has set for voting in the state of Arizona.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I agree with John that this is like making them jump through a whole bunch of pretend hoops when we all sort of know what the answer is, right? Which is, there's no one home. So knock on the door all you want, but there's no one home. Why are we doing this? But
is the popular, Eric, is the popular press going to get to that answer, or are they just going to go with a glossy headline?
We buried in footnote 10 on the second to last page of Scalia's opinion. The popular press is going to skim right over that baby. And, you know, the blog guys will get it, right? All of the guys who will comment on it in the days to come will get it. And maybe in a day or two, the press will catch up. But no, I'm guessing the first round coverage says Arizona loses, when in fact the answer is Arizona wins small. Is what the headline ought to read, right?
Now, is that a willing blindness on the part of the popular press, or just an inability to get to the facts, or they just want Arizona to lose? What's your analysis of that?
I think more the second than the first, combined with maybe a little bit of happiness with the answer that is the one that is obvious on its face. So the obvious answer is Arizona loses, right? They lost. That's not a wrong statement. It just requires a little more work to figure out why it's a misleading statement. So I don't think you can't sort of attribute malice to the press for not having gotten to the last sentence in footnote 10 on the second to last page of Scalia's 25-page opinion, right? They need to get their articles out. They need to get the headline written, and the headline is accurate as far as it goes. They'll get there. I give them a little more slack.
But in the syllabus of the opinion, which one presumes the press will read before they do their articles, it does outline Arizona can come back. They can ask for this to be included. And quite frankly, if they demonstrate that this is necessary to determine eligibility for a voting qualification that they alone get to set, that it would be a non-discretionary duty of the federal agency to put this on the federal form. And that's right there in the syllabus. So I think even the press ought to have that bit of the information as part of this. Arizona temporarily loses but will ultimately win. It should be the headline.
It should be the headline. And who knows? Maybe they'll get it. But if they miss it, I'm willing to attribute it to the press of time rather than malice. I don't think they're trying to get it wrong, even if I'm sure that there were more smiles than not at the prospect of Arizona loses. I think they'd just as soon get it right than get it wrong. So, but that's neither here nor there, right? The answer is they'll get it eventually, because certainly plenty of commentators will point it out and they'll catch up. So we'll see. Maybe my prediction will be wrong and the press will outperform my low expectations of them.
Once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let me ask a question of Professor Yelderman. Professor, we see, it seems to me, you're an expert in this area. I don't pretend expertise, but it seems we're getting a lot more intellectual property, a lot more patent cases at the level of the Supreme Court. What's your analysis of the reason for that? Are they dissatisfied with what's happening in the lower courts, or what do you have to say about that, if that perception is correct?
Well, I guess it's interesting, you know, whether we think of this as primarily a patent case or primarily an antitrust case. You know, obviously it has a little bit of both. You know, this is, you know, we've actually seen an uptick in patent antitrust cases as well recently, and these sort of evaluating, you know, the relationship between intellectual property rights, not just patents, but intellectual property rights more generally, and the antitrust laws. So obviously that's very very exciting to see. I mean, in terms of your question specifically about, you know, more attention paid to patent law, you know, obviously it's an area where there is a lot of public outcry about, you know, sort of the way things are operating right now in the patent system. You know, as I said before, I think that there might be some lurking concern about your rampant patent invalidity, you know, motivating this case, or at least factoring into, you know, the way, perhaps the reason we're now departing from the formalism of presuming patent validity for the purposes of antitrust analysis. I think that I'm sure that's a factor in terms of, you know, the court's more recent attention paid to all these patent cases, but of course. Yeah. How and why cert is actually granted, I can't speculate about, but I do think that there is a widespread perception that is influencing people and bringing a lot of attention to these cases.
All right, very good. Let me make a last call for questions. If you have a call for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Our lines are open. Okay. Well, apparently, folks on our call, we still have plenty of people. Well, we do have one question. Let's go to this next question from the audience.
This is Paul Larkin from the Heritage Foundation. I have a question about the Fifth Amendment case today. The Fifth Amendment case, to some extent, dealt with the application of an old Supreme Court decision by the name of Griffin versus California outside of the trial context. To what extent do you think that today's decision indicates some concern on the part of more than just the concurring judges, justices, with the continued validity of that decision?
So this is Brian Murray. That's an interesting question. I mean, Justice Thomas was pretty clear in reiterating his, you know, longstanding view that Griffin was wrongly decided, has no basis in the text or the history or logic of the Constitution, and should be uprooted and, or at the very least not extended outside of the purely judicial context. The fact that he sort of wrote that as, you know, purely as he has in the past and didn't get the three justices in the plurality opinion to come along, at least to me, suggests that there's some disagreement there, that the hardline version of that may not yet be palatable to everyone who is in the, you know, the majority side of that opinion. I'd be curious what other folks on the call think about, you know, long-term viability of that.
Well, John Eastman or Eric Jaffe, you, any comment on that?
None for me. Just not my area of the law, so I defer claiming ignorance.
As do I. I've unfortunately had not had a chance to read the opinion to try and think through the tectonic nuances that are there.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well,
Dean, before we should yeah. let me go back to this idea in the Arizona case. That proof of citizenship is the same thing as eligibility, and we see this happening in a number of different arenas now. For example, the welfare benefits system, which requires that you be citizen or a lawful immigrant, and the claims being made that illegal immigrants are not taking any of those benefits because, of course, it's a requirement that you be a citizen or a lawful permanent resident here before you're eligible. And yet we see in arena after arena after arena the disconnect between the requirement that you be eligible citizen or lawful permanent resident and verification of your eligibility, which almost uniformly the federal government is refusing to require it with the complicity of a number of state and local jurisdictions. And we see that playing out in this Arizona case as well. Arizona has the unquestioned constitutional authority to make citizenship a requirement for voting, and yet the federal government is standing as a barrier to confirming that eligibility and won't prosecute anybody for actually fraudulently claiming eligibility on their federal voter registration form. That disconnect that we see manifested in this case, I think, explains part of Arizona's frustration here and in a number of other arenas.
You're saying something, I assume here, John, that is lighting up our audience. So let's go to our next caller question.
Hi, this is Adam Mossoff, a professor of law at George Mason University School of Law and co-director of academic programs for the Center for Protection of Individual Rights. I actually have a question again for Professor Steve Yelderman on the FTC v. Actavis decision. he did a very nice summary of the case, and I enjoyed also his analysis of perhaps why the Supreme Court is involved in this issue. And I'd be interested to hear perhaps what he thinks a little bit about the Supreme Court's reaction against this formalism, whether correct or incorrect, in the underlying jurisprudence, either at the Federal Circuit and other courts, with respect to patents. In his dissent, Chief Justice Roberts noted that while standards-based regimes like rule of reason analysis in antitrust law carry with them this perception of being fact-based and very specific to the context and being very precise, as he noted, the indeterminacy that comes from this can actually prevent settlements from being reached because it produces what some scholars refer to as reverse holdup. So as opposed to the holdup by the property right owner here, the patentee, it produces a holdup by the defendant, who says, I'd rather take my chances at court and roll the dice because of the uncertainties that are involved here. And I'm just curious to hear about what his sense is of the policy implications of that, both in the pharmaceutical context or even maybe a little broader. Thank you.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, that is the countervailing concern here, right? I mean, particularly if we want to ensure settlement, and we both doubly like certainty and like settlement, a ruling that puts an obstacle in front of both is potentially a concern. Obviously, there are going to be cases that are close to the line, and. And many antitrust situations, there's lots of gray area. There's plenty of agreements that are rule of reason analysis and sort of, create this question of sort of how much is too much, in terms of whether it's input foreclosure or other kinds of pricing decisions. There's all kinds of matters in antitrust law where it's a matter of degree rather than kind. While that obviously is going to require closer counseling and caution in settlement, at the same time, I think that the court recognizes that there are extreme cases, and maybe this is a matter for the FTC's discretion. Maybe there's guidance that can be put out, or ultimately, closed cases, will produce. Clearer law in the form of judicial opinions, but I think it's realistic here for the court to recognize that we can say that sometimes a spade is a spade. There are some settlements where the only value that we can see here is a sort of exclusionary value, this sort of paying our way out of the Hatch-Waxman incentives, of course it's a balancing, and hopefully we'll get further clarity. From the FTC and/or court that will provide guidance while at the same time balancing these incentives correctly.
Very good. Let me give each of our speakers just a quick opportunity for a final thought, and let's go in the same order we began in. I don't want to foreclose any conversation here. Eric Jaffe, final thought?
I guess my final thought was what a spectacular waste of time this case was. To sort of come out this way, while I sort of appreciate the sort of proceduralist approach to it, I probably lean more towards John's approach, which is at the end of the day, you're asking a state to say mother may I to an agency that doesn't exist and couldn't say no even if it did, and I just don't understand why we spent so much time getting there, and we'll spend the next God knows how many years getting there. So it's disappointing for it to come out with such a sort of an anti-climax of you win, but we're not going to say it, and we're going to make it difficult to actually reap the fruits of your victory, and we're going to make it look like you lost. It seems like a poor use of this case.
All right. John Eastman, can you improve on that?
And I'll pick up on that theme and point out that there are real collateral consequences here beyond just the delays for Arizona. Elections will be affected by the procedural hurdles that have now been placed before Arizona to vindicate their constitutional authority to impose a citizenship requirement on voting. And they won't be able to determine eligibility. That means everybody else who are valid citizens casting a vote will have their votes diluted with potentially outcome determinative consequences by folks who are voting illegally and yet can't be confirmed in their eligibility on the front end of an election. This will likely affect the 2014 election in Arizona and maybe the 2016 presidential election as well, and it will slow down any other state's efforts to strengthen their eligibility confirmation process to prove their citizenship eligibility qualification as well.
All right. On the criminal cases, Brian Murray, final thought?
You know, the most interesting part of the whole Salinas decision is this new uncertainty that's now interjected into this line of cases about what does it mean to actually invoke your right and what is sufficient. I mean, we're just digesting this case today, but my guess is in the weeks and months that will follow, there's going to be a lot of brain power spent on trying to figure out what is a sufficient invocation and how ought you to advise your clients, especially those who might be wary of leading with, hey, I'm invoking my right against self-incrimination. How might you advise them to answer questions when government investigators come knocking? Now, as a practitioner and happily one who bills by the hour, these are things I'd be happy to devote some brain cells to. So this being a Federal Society Teleforum call, if any of you are getting calls from the IRS and want to think through those questions, feel free to give me a call.
And Professor Yelderman, a final thought on the reverse payments case.
I would just point out that this is the beginning rather than the end. The FTC has attempted to be very active in this area. This allows them to proceed, and we'll wait and see what further guidance is produced in the course of these litigations as they continue.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Brian Murray, Eric Jaffe, and Professors Yelderman and Eastman for joining us, especially on such short notice. This call was just constructed sort of on the fly at about 10:30 after the decisions came out. We certainly appreciate you joining us on such short notice. For our audience, I invite you to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we'll take a closer look at the myriad decision of the court, I think from last week or the week before. It's tomorrow at 3 p.m., but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.